Just to start the discussion session, what thought I'd say first is that we want to try and encourage people to participate in this as much as possible. I've prepared a few talking points just to give us a bit of structure and to keep us moving along. But really, I think it's for everybody else to dive in and start talking. And in that spirit, I'd also like to encourage you to, turn on your video. I guess it helps us all to see each other's faces and interact a bit more. So if you haven't got your video on and you're happy to do so, and you don't mind, I guess, the recording having your face on it, you can turn on your video now, and that'll give us a hopefully help the discussion along. So I was asked to just lead this discussion on numerical techniques, and as we heard, I think the discussion sessions are really the most useful part that comes out of CAPRA quite often. So hopefully that'll continue in this this one. I've put together a few talking points, which maybe I'll just list the kind of the high-level topics I thought we might be interested in talking about. Some came out of the talks earlier today, and some were ones that I had kind of thought about just before the start of the conference. We don't have to stick to this list, but at least it gives us a few starting points. And the last one here actually will kind of link into what Niels was planning to talk about to lead in his discussion session. So when we get to the last one, we might actually swap over to Niels leading the discussion at that point. So earlier today, we saw some nice talks about time domain methods and ways to make them highly accurate and efficient. And that's something I thought maybe we should talk a bit more about, how to make use of those. There was some nice progress towards a method for doing perturbations of Kerr, in particular the case where you might have a source, which is very important for doing second order. I have another topic on here is actually second order self-force itself. There is a separate discussion for that on Wednesday, so we don't need to spend all the time on that, but it might be good to start thinking about a few things now, and we can pick it up again on Wednesday when I think Adam is leading that discussion. I thought maybe I could mention a few points about the Black Hole Perturbation Toolkit as a means for gathering together all the expertise we have. And then the last topic I thought would be interesting would be comparisons of waveforms and how we might start to make those now that we're starting to get to the point of actually having waveforms. We'd like to be able to see how accurate they are and have independent tests of that and that sort of thing. So I'm keen not to be talking forever here. So maybe what I suggest we do is I've got one slide for each of these with just a few suggested talking points, and hopefully maybe that might get us started. So let's go on to the first topic, so the time domain methods. Okay, so it was very nice to see these talks earlier today about improve, efficient and accurate ways to do time domain evolution. I think there was enthusiasm from the speakers and kind of ideas about how they might actually start applying those to the sort of calculations that other people in the community are doing. So maybe that's one thing we could talk about. I think time domain methods in general have advantages and disadvantages, and we should be tailoring them to where they're the problems where they're most well suited. So we might think about what sort of problems should we be trying to tackle with time domain methods, and what sort of questions we should be answering with them. Where are they most uniquely well suited as opposed to other methods? So I don't know, do we have some speakers, Harris or anyone from earlier, who would like to chime in on this? Or I see Peter Diener there as well, another person who's worked on these. Yep, go on ahead.
Yes, so first of all, are there any questions from the morning session that anyone has?
Actually, I have a question if it's okay.
Okay.
I remember the talk on where the person mentioned instabilities and black hole turbulence. Was he actually talking about real chaotic turbulence, and how do you detect chaos when you're using perturbative methods?
That was a talk referencing work myself and Juan Yang had done some time ago. I can put the archive link in the chat. Very, very, very briefly, we were investigating parametric instabilities in very fast rotating Kerr black holes at perturbation theory. And it's more accurate to say we found parametric instabilities that displayed hallmarks of turbulence, things like inverse cascades and direct cascades. But we didn't actually see full-blown turbulence in that sense.
Thank you.
So is there anyone else who has any further questions about the talks from earlier or comments?
So I was just thinking about a remark made by Martin earlier about the error accumulated in time domain methods. And I was just thinking if, you know, what are all the sources of this error? And if perhaps we know methods that could eliminate them, because it seems to me we could in principle. So maybe that's something to kick off this sort of discussion.
Yeah, so that's a good topic. From our point of view, with time domain methods, we see round of error accumulating in each time step. So part of it is from the special discretization where we have a matrix multiplication in each time step. So matrix multiplication, you have a sum over hundreds or thousands of points. And that summation is not compensated usually by libraries. So one would have to construct the special versions of those libraries. I think there is one in Julia, for example, which does compensate a summation in matrix multiplication. And that would help reduce round off error by one or two orders of magnitude in each time step. And then that, of course, adds up over time. And there's also some tricks that we have found that they help. For example, if instead of doing one matrix multiplication in each time step, instead, you can just separate out the difference in each time step. So you do a matrix multiply and addition instead of a simple matrix multiply. We found that energy is preserved much better to machine precision if you do that compared to just doing a matrix multiplication. So we're going to publish this soon. But yeah, there are a lot of tricks like that you can do to reduce the error. And of course, you can do compensated summation time as well, if you want. So all of this is just to reduce round of error. It's not even, you know, finite difference or in time integration error.
Are there any other questions from people here in the audience?
I'd just like to ask if the person who asked that question, I'm sorry I didn't see who it was, had specific ideas about how to reduce specific errors that maybe are not being implemented yet.
So I don't know. So there was, so for instance, I haven't worked on this directly, but there is a PhD student, I don't know if he is here, Victor, who has been working with a time domain Teukolsky code. And the issue there, for instance, the main source of error is the singular source in the Teukolsky equation, right? Which, you know, speaking to the expert on this, could in principle be removed by some kind of singular source method or some kind of local pre-integration of the singular part of the field and so on. So which, for instance, in time domain Tsiolkovsky code, what is done is they basically put a Gaussian there or some sort of discrete delta function in the place of the source in the Tsiolkovsky equation. So I think that's definitely something that could be improved.
Yeah, so I think putting in a Gaussian is not very accurate. It's the easiest, probably, but not a very accurate way to do it. I think the way that Peter Diener is doing it, for example, is the most accurate, probably, where you do domain decomposition. And you then you can use a pseudospectral method left and right of the particle. Then you have to deal with the fact that your coordinates keep moving. So you cannot store your matrices and your grid, I'm assuming, because of that reason. In some sense, that's a Lagrangian approach where you follow the particle with your grid. And complementary to that is the method that Lydia talked about in the morning, which is to instead generalize Lagrange interpolation and Hermite interpolation to include a known discontinuity at some point. So we make use of the jumps that we can calculate analytically, actually, from the equation of motion, and we inform those numerical methods. We know the location and the magnitude of the discontinuity, and we can calculate jumps up to higher order. Then you can write a discontinuous numerical differentiation matrix and a discontinuous time integration method that takes those jumps into account. And that is almost as accurate as the other method, the domain decomposition. It doesn't have exponential convergence, but you know, if you add 20 jumps, then you have 20th order convergence. But then the complication is that the jumps get more and more complicated as you go to higher and higher order. So it's not easy to go beyond 10 or 15 jumps. It tends to get harder and harder. That's the limitation there. The advantage then is that in the second case, your grid is fixed and the particle is free to move inside your domain. It doesn't have to be on a grid point. And that means that you can still store your matrices. And that makes coding much more efficient and a lot easier.
So just a quick question about that. This is mainly about 1+1D codes, right? Not 2+1 codes, probably.
Right. So doing the jumps it's doable in 1+1. In 2+1, it will. You'll start to have to deal with mixed derivative jumps, and it will get out of control. But you can always decompose care perturbations in spin-weighted spherical harmonics and reduce them to 1+1. And the coupling goes to next to nearest neighbors. And there are a few papers that do that. And they use Clebsch-Gordan coefficients to calculate this coupling. So yeah, it's always possible to reduce the problem to 1+1. But the price you pay is that you have coupled L modes.
I have a question. Do you know how many L modes must be summed for a good precision?
That depends on what you're doing.
Depends on eccentricity and all that stuff. And yeah, it you would have to determine that on a case by case basis.
So to give an extreme example, if you want circular orbits near the horizon of a nearly extreme black hole, it may be 100. if you want really high precision.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
That is quite an extreme example.
Yeah.
As the name suggests, nearly extreme example.
Yeah, but more likely somewhere between 10 and 30.
I think I remember there was a talk at the APS meeting at this last April that was quantifying the number of L modes that you needed to keep as a function of eccentricity and stuff like that. But I don't remember who gave the talk or if the work was published already.
The number of modes you keep is also going to depend on the, in some sense, the order of your scheme. As a couple of speakers noted earlier, if you add quote unquote higher order regularization coefficients in your scheme of the sort that I think Anne Heffernan has calculated, you can get faster convergence with L and thus not need as many L modes for the same accuracy. Of course, the calculations get more complicated at each L, so there's a trade-off there.
I have a naive question in this direction. Perhaps it's too naive. But so I would think that when you are decomposing into the spherical harmonics, this is a sort of spectral methods, right? You just have a basis that you're decomposing in the angular basis. So in principle, convergence should be exponential. So the loss of convergence is precisely because the source would have a jump at the theta angle as well. So where does this loss of convergence comes from?
In the angular I was wondering direction? About the same thing, actually. Yeah.
It's because the solution is not smooth at the sort first.
Yeah, so I mean, that is precisely because of the delta function, the same way that we have something at the radial direction, there is something of the theta.
Yeah, so I think in principle, the way we handle jumps in the time and radial direction, we can probably extend that to the theta and phi direction and calculate the jumps in advance and make use of it. Of that knowledge, but I'm not sure if anyone has tried this.
Some sort of multi-domain in the angular direction somehow. So this is somehow what I, at some point I was having in my mind.
Yeah, or have this continuous coefficient. So the coefficients of the modes would have a jump across a particle.
Could that not also
so they would have a jump in the theta and in the phi direction.
Could there not also be singularities that depend on the direction? The singularity at the point and depending on the direction from which you approach it, you have a different value. And then just splitting it in both theta and radial direction would not work. You'd have to do something more clever.
Yes, I think that there are delta function and even delta prime and maybe even delta double prime sources. You would have to add those separately.
What I'm thinking of is weaker than a delta function. It's just like, say, on the North Pole, the angle phi has different values if you come from different directions. But it's still kind of like a discontinuity.
Can I burst in for a moment? Leo here.
Yes, I'm here. I think so. Let me just, before you say that, Leo, just there was a question in the chat saying, is this open to everybody? I just want to reiterate, this is an open forum for discussion. So please feel free to put in with questions or statements or whatever you think is useful. So go ahead, Leo.
Yeah, just to say, Harris, you're thinking about jumps, but if you're in 2+1, there are no jumps, there are actual singularities, logarithmic in this case. So that's not going to work the way it works in 1+1. And Eric is right in that you have this complicated angular dependence. And so it's not clear how to implement this kind of architecture you were talking about to the 2+1 problem.
Okay, I'll have to look at the source terms to see what we can do. So where do the logarithms the logarithmic singularities come from.
Oh, so you say in 2 plus 1, the Coulomb singularity is logarithmic. Look at my paper with Darren. We explore the form of the logarithmic divergence. What you can do is remove the divergence with a puncture, and then you're left with something that has that is just discontinuous, but it has this directional dependence discontinuity. So of course it's smooth as you go around the particle, but it is singular, this is conical singularity as you approach the not conical but there's a direction dependence as you approach the particle. And how to do that with the domain decomposition, I don't know.
So isn't it possible to just assume a discontinuity in the theta and phi direction of the coefficients, of the expansion coefficients, to use a step function to...
step function in what?
In theta and in
phi. No, because you don't have it's not a step theta in, step function in theta. There's no jump away from the particle. There's only one singular point at each time, which is the particle. A theta function in theta is a discontinuity on a sphere. Mm-hmm.
So which paper did you say with?
My paper with Goldborn was 2005-ish.
Okay.
So we do a 2 plus 1, and we sort of analyze the logarithmic singularity.
I think it's 2007 or 2007,
was it? Okay.
Can I ask, the logarithmic divergent is in the case of delta function source or some derivatives of delta function?
Yeah, if you have a delta function source, then the field diverges logarithmically in 2 plus 1.
So for Tobolsky equation with spinning particle term, I guess the divergence is different.
Yeah, I would imagine so. So I'd imagine just the Tobolsky equation itself has more than the delta function, even before you add on the spinning. Yeah, it's what a delta and a delta primed. Delta double primed.
Tobolsky has delta double primed.
And then the spinning term adds a triple primed. So it will be more divergent for sure.
And I'm not sure the divergence will actually be on the confined to the particle, but I'm not sure of that. You may get this string-like things. Yeah, but at the very least, it will be a total mess of a singularity.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how we're doing on time. We've got 45 minutes for this discussion. We're still on the first topic. We can keep going with this, or should we maybe go on to one of the other ones?
Well, we haven't said much about the last two points on this slide. Does anybody want to comment on that before we go on?
Yeah, good point, Bernard. So what should be the target for time domain methods?
So I guess I have a question maybe people can say if they've already looked into it. There's this growing evidence that we're going to be able to apply self-force calculations to comparable mass systems. What is being detected in ground-based gravitational wave detectors is the last few cycles plunge merger of many of these systems. So it seems like a good target might be the transition into plunge and merger. We don't care about that for Emery so much because, of course, it's such a tiny perturbation to the phase at the very end. But if we want to stretch into other regimes of validity, this might be interesting, and this seems naturally suited for time domain calculations.
That's a very good point, Aaron, thanks.
I agree, and there's certainly something that I would be interested in. And I think it should be doable as well.
Certainly people are already starting to do this. You know, Tusis talk today, they were including the plunge and ring down.
I see. I see Adam raise his hand as well. Adam, if you want to chime in on this.
Yeah, is my audio working?
Yep.
Great. Yeah, I'm just not so sure about that last point that the transition to plunge is best dealt with in the time domain. I think through most of it, you still have a clear separation of timescales, and the frequency domain would still be probably preferable. Although, of course, you'll want to transition to the time domain right at the end.
Yeah, so I might make that a question. So, you know, there's the adiabatic approximation could still work up to perhaps just about the ISCO. But of course, that transition layer becomes much, much bigger as the mass ratios go towards one. And so I actually don't know if it's more efficient, theoretically, calculationally, et cetera, if you only had 10 orbits in merger at semi-comparable mass ratios, what one should do there, if the post-adiabatic approach is the best approach to get to the last cycle or two.
So Niels on Wednesday will show results for the second order flux and how it goes pretty badly wrong using the two timescale approximation in the lead up to the ISCO. And yeah, the transition region gets pretty big, but it's still, you know, three or four orbits only.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it remains an open question, I think, which one would be preferable.
Yeah, I have a related question or note on this comparable mass ratio system. So if you want to generate the waveform for, let's say, two non-spinning Schwarzschild black hole comparable mass ratio, the natural Emery waveform you want to use, the Emery system you want to use for this mapping is a Schwarzschild black hole with a test particle. But then for this comparable mass ratio system at the very late stage of the in-spiral, I mean, and if you can imagine this closed limit, right? So the effective spacetime is no longer a Schwarzschild spacetime. It's actually the final black hole is a curved black hole. So actually the merger frequency is higher than the ISCO frequency of the Schwarzschild black hole with the same total mass. So then that means if you want to do this mapping, you're not going to be able to generate the waveform for the very late part of the in-spiral, because if you use a Schwarzschild black hole, then you can only evolve up to ISCO, then plunge.
So the change in the spin of the big black hole will still be pretty small. So we can deal with it perturbatively. But I agree that you'd probably want to basically start with the final spin and expand around that.
Yeah, so, well, I guess my question is, do we want to use this Schwarzschild black hole plus test particle to generate this waveform, right? Because if you use this system to map it to the comparable mass ratio limit, you cannot evolve the system, I mean, beyond the ISCO frequency, but for the comparable mass ratio system, the merger frequency is higher than the ISCO frequency for Schwarzschild black hole with the same mass. So I don't know, when Martin did this comparison for comparable mass ratio systems with numerical relativity, right? Like, did you all the way compare it to the merger frequency, or you cut off before the merger frequency?
Those comparisons were all cut off at the ISCO frequency. So,
yeah.
However, if we're doing a self-consistent time domain self-force calculation, I see no reason why that should be cut off at the ISCO frequency.
You cut off the ISCO frequency of a Schwarzschild.
Because all the perturbation in the spin will actually be part of the metric perturbation. The only problem there is that at some point the metric perturbation will stop being small, which may cause problems. And I think if we would actually want to do that, we would have to start by sort of recasting the whole formalism to be an expansion in the symmetric mass ratio rather than the ordinary mass ratio. because it's with the symmetric mass ratio expansion that everything seems to work out really, really well in the comparable mass regime. If you would try the comparisons with just normal mass ratio, you would already be very far off. So you would have to do a sort of effective one body self force setup.
But we're already doing that. When would we ever use the expansion in the non-symmetric mass ratio to actually do real things with?
Yeah, anyway, I was just saying that I mean even if you use symmetric mass ratio to do the mapping, if the Emery system you're using is a Schwarzschild black hole, then you can only evolve to the E-scale frequency of that Schwarzschild. And for a comparable mass ratio system, the merger frequency is higher than that. So I don't know how to do for this very late part between these two frequencies.
But if you're doing a time domain calculation, it will at some point, the perturbation that you're adding will be the perturbation away from it being a Schwarzschild black hole to a Kerr black hole. The only problem is that perturbation is at some point going to be big, which may be problematic.
The perturbation of what? Sorry.
So one part of the perturbation that we calculate is the perturbation of the black hole away from Kerr or away from Schwarzschild. Mm-hmm. But that is part of the first order metric perturbation. Of course, curving a Schwarzschild black hole to a spin of 0.7 isn't a small perturbation anymore. So, because at some point you may end up being almost inside the horizon for Schwarzschild. That sounds more problematic.
Yeah, so Louis is right in the chat. Louis is saying, why not use a final spin of the final black hole? I guess that's actually better. If you use the final spin, if you use a black hole with the same spin as the final black hole, and then you get, then basically you can evolve all the way to the merger frequency. But then at the earlier part, right, then it doesn't justify, in the early part of the spiral, doesn't justify why you would want a rotating black hole as a background. So maybe there is a matching needed here.
Then we don't know how to calculate the self force once the particle crosses the horizon, I guess. Maybe Lear has something to say.
Sorry, what was the question?
So we're talking about the final spin and if it's a large perturbation, but once the particle crosses the horizon, but we don't even know how to calculate the self force when the particle crosses the horizon.
When the particle crosses the horizon?
Yeah.
Why would you be interested in calculating that?
That would be the final stage of the merger.
So you mean when the particle crosses the E-scale? So I think what one asks is if you want to do a self-force calculation but then push it to extreme mass, to equal mass, then of course your final black hole is not going to be Schwarzschild. It's going to be a very fast rotating Kerr, but you're only going to do the calculation up to the Schwarzschild E-scale, so you're going to miss a big portion of the evolution. I think Adam's suggestion is perfectly reasonable, just to use the final spin. But that means, interestingly, that you need to do a different self-force calculation for each mass ratio. Whereas now you do one self-force calculation for all mass ratios, right? You need to do one for each central spin. Your mass ratio will determine the final spin and will determine the self-force calculation that you need to do. But that's just a detail. Yeah. I think it makes sense to use the final spin, but I'm not sure if this is the question you're asking, actually.
But Lear, if you're doing a self-consistent evolution, wouldn't you have to fix the mass ratio to begin with?
Yes, no, but then you can only go up to the E-scale of the Schwarzschild black hole or whatever your black hole in the center is.
Well, why if you're doing a self-consistent evolution, can you only go up to the ISCO? I don't understand.
Oh, you can plunge through the ISCO, but that then won't describe the system. Then you won't be able to extrapolate to equal mass correctly. But because in the equal mass case, you have a much...
You're doing a self-consistent evolution, you will have your ISCO shifted. ISCO shift will already be included.
No, but you're doing a point particle on a Schwarzschild black hole, and you'll have a transition across the ISCO, and that's fair enough. But now you want to use that for equal mass, your result you want to apply to equal mass. By the equal mass case, you'll end up with a very large, fast rotating Kerr black hole, where the ISCO is entirely in an entirely different place. So surely your approximation is not going to be very good around the transition regime.
We could say this exact same thing about any aspect of the geometry, right? Two equal mass black holes have an extremely different structure of curvature around the black holes than a small particle falling into a black hole. And yet there are indications, for reasons that I presume are still mysterious, that this kind of works. So I don't think it's clear which approach would work better in taking this extrapolation or resummation or whatever you want to call it. Right, because in the end, what you're going to do is you're going to say calculate the waveform, and you could calculate the waveform from a self-forced orbit through plunge and merger, and you can just see if with the appropriate rescalings of frequency, etc., you can make a good match to numerical simulations, and as we've just said, Tusev's work, I think, and work like that indicates that also may be possible. So. I'm not sure it is a problem because we don't quite know how it's supposed to work, right? All we know so far is you do something that works in the extreme mass limit, and then people have found ways to extrapolate it, right? And with connections to post-Newtonian, I guess there's a good understanding of maybe what should work, but we don't compare, you know, we don't have to have the geometry be the same.
But Aaron, can I ask a question on that point? I mean, if that's true, or if this is solid, we should be able to think of any problems. In particular, I could think of the problem where I set up my initial particle is in a circular orbit, and then I would let the radiation to take it into wherever I want. But if I'm using a space-time background that is that of Schwarzschild, and I happen to put it at 5.3 m, let's say, that particle wants to plunge in. It won't be the same behavior if that black hole space-time has a spin of 0.9.
Yeah, I mean, the mapping certainly has to rescale the frequencies, and we know that, right? I mean,
It's not just the frequency, right? So if I turn off gravitational radiation, I know I could put a particle at 5.7 on a black hole on a Schwarzschild, on a spinning black hole space time that is sufficiently have high speed spinning. I could put a particle there. And if I have arbitrary precision, it will just stay there in a circular trajectory. That won't happen if I try to do it in Schwarzschild. So my perturbation will have to work really hard to
actually
do two things.
I'm not sure about that, because if you would include the self-force would include a massive ISCO shift and actually allow you to have circular orbits far inside of the background ISCO.
I can appreciate that, and if it works, that's amazing. Because I mean, in one case, I'm asking the perturbation to tell me to push me in the right direction, and it's correcting an order, a small thing that I'm making a mistake on. Here, I'm making an order one mistake, so I would be. Maybe it's in a very special case it would work, but I would be surprised if it works in general. But I would be extremely happy if I'm wrong.
Can I ask a question just to make sure that I'm following what's going on? So I thought that what Juan was originally asking was, you know, basically we want some map from comparable mass ratio systems to extreme mass ratio systems so that we can use self-force calculations, right? Which is more or less what the goal of EOB was. But I thought that the original EOB, and I don't know what the state of the art is now, but the corresponding one effective one-body system that you map onto from like equal mass non-spinning BBH system is not a small body going around a Schwarzschild black hole, or at least, you know, the original map that they constructed, it wasn't around a Schwarzschild black hole. It was around a spinning black hole. And I think it was exactly because of this higher frequency shift effect that you're talking about.
No, actually the EUB mapping for non-spinning binaries is onto a deformed Schwarzschild black hole.
Okay, well then—
There's no spinning black hole.
Then I'm misinformed.
Which is one of the things that sort of frustrates me.
The original EUB map was. But I was under the impression that it mapped onto a Kerr black hole.
Well, now they are trying to, but you know, in the first 15 years of EUB, it was around Schwarzschilds. But exactly because of this kind of concerns, later on, we're looking at making it care. So yes, miracles have happened. I don't think any of us can claim with certainty that it's going to work, but miracles have happened and it may work.
I mean, EUB works pretty well doing nothing. Like, yeah, calibrating against
that. For the non-spinning case. For the non-spinning case. I think the spinning case, the agreement is less good.
Right, but what we're talking about now is, do you need to take into account the big final spin? Right. If you're starting off with non-rotating things.
Right. Yeah.
So to interrupt there, we're getting close to the end of the 45 minutes that we have for this discussion. Should we maybe try to, in the 2 minutes that we have left, try to discuss some other things? Or I think there's a lot of discussion coming out of this. Maybe we should continue some of these on Slack. If there's Anna, is that the best place to do it, to kind of follow up this discussion? Yeah, Anna says, yeah. So maybe, I mean, I would suggest that we do that. And I'm not sure if we have much time, but if Niels doesn't mind, we'll start, maybe at least touch on a couple of the other topics, and then we can kind of transition over to what to the things you have prepared, Niels. That's okay with everyone. I don't want to be forcing that on everyone. We're having a good discussion here, but maybe we'll just I'll just mention the things that I thought might be interesting to also discuss, and we can get them started and follow up on Slack at least. I mean, the other thing I think we should really be thinking about is frequency domain methods and how we're going to start applying them to Kerr, in particular when we try to do second order in Kerr, where you have a source that is non-compact. We need a method to do that, and we certainly don't have one that's fully developed just yet. I could certainly think of three methods listed here that are looking promising. The one we saw earlier that looked very nice, that was applied to the scalar case. If that could be applied to Lorentz gauge, that could be very useful. There's also some recent work on doing radiation gauge with sources, or even trying to reconstruct Lorentz gauge metric perturbations, perhaps with sources. So does anyone have any thoughts about that, about how feasible any of these are, or any comments?
When you say time domain with sources, you mean with delta function sources or effective sources?
I guess, well, what I was really thinking about here was that for doing second order, we have to solve an equation where the source term is, the right-hand side is basically the first order perturbation, which is everywhere. So trying to solve that type of problem, either in the frequency domain or even in the time domain, I guess. But a lot of the radiation gauge stuff has difficulties with sources, which I know, I see Stephen Green here has done some work on trying to resolve those, but what are the prospects? We're going to need to solve this to do second order in Kerr. We're going to need to do something.
For the 2D version, sorry.
Yeah, I was sorry, go ahead, yeah.
I was going to just quickly say, for the 2D solving elliptic equations, I don't see any reason why you couldn't just do that right away for the gravitational case in Lorentz gauge. I think if you're looking ahead to second order, you would need to do hyperboloidal slicing at, in some form to make the second order part of the post-adiabatic expansion work nicely. But I, that part isn't the problem because you could do that without compactification. For circular orbits, I think that the 2D one is promising. For non-circular, maybe. I think a lot of development would have to happen for eccentric or inclined for that to work well.
Great. I see Patrice, you've got your hand raised there.
Sorry to interrupt this lovely discussion, but I think it's time to move on to our next discussion session.